I think the problem with this movie is it's 2 hours and 20 minutes fucking long.
Yeah, I was drawing X's with my fingers over scenes that didn't need to exist.
You are such a passive-aggressive cunt.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
We still exist.
We're not pod fading.
No. And with me is the host, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
It's that time of the year. It's spooky. It's creepy. It's
kooky.
Kooky crisp. Count Chocula. It's a Halloween month. It's October. So we have a bunch of things planned for the Halloween festivities. today we're going to be reviewing.
Before we get into it, I'm like really fucking excited for Halloween this year.
Yeah.
Like,
you got stuff planned?
No.
Actual like plans?
No.
Or you're in the season. You're in the mood.
Yeah. So like the last couple years, I was kind of going through like a bout of anxiety a bit. And like horror did not appeal to me and
right.
in my mindset at the time. But this year I'm like, bring it the fuck on. Mm-hmm. I want to go hard.
Through exposure therapy of being on the podcast, watching movies like Hereditary, you have now overcome.
Actually, kind of. Hereditary actually sort of reminded me how much I love horror when it's good.
Right.
That's how fucking good that movie was.
Yeah, it's still a really strong contender in and around my top five if I'm, you know, looking at my rough draft of it. And it's been a pretty good year for horror in general.
It's been a good couple years.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, there's always a few like interesting things that come out that I end up talking about, but it's a good year to get back into it.
Yeah, so I'm fucking excited for Halloween, for the spooks and the creeps and the chills and the sweeps.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things people are excited about when they're talking about Halloween. today, we're going to be reviewing The Predator. We've talked a lot about Predator in the last few episodes, but today we're going to be talking about Shane Black's new entry into the canon. We're also going to be doing a Halloween draft. We're going to be talking about best horror films of the 70s, but we're going to be kind of compiling that list in a more interesting way. And at the end of the program, to top off the beginning of the Halloween season, we're going to be talking about the 1976 version of A Star Is Born.
This isn't your B-Coops and your El Gaga.
Not your Lady Gaga's. That didn't work out like I wanted it to. I would have liked to start talking exclusively about horror films and the Netflix homework, but the way things worked out, we gotta get this one out of the way.
Yeah, but it's we'll okay. Get there. It's all right.
It's okay. It kind of ties in with our 70s thing, I think, a little bit. So
yeah,
it's kind of there. But yeah, let's get into it. We're going to be doing our Halloween draft. This week, we're going to be focusing on horror films from the 1970s, and as we go through the month, we'll be going through the 80s next week, the 90s, and then the 2000s last. So this is kind of a way to sort of like focus in on something, less of a broader pool to choose from, and hopefully some less obvious picks. So the way this is going to work out is I'm going to pick one, Keith is going to pick one, and we'll go back and forth like that until we have a list of 10. And if he chooses one that was on my list, I have to cross it out and vice versa. So yep. How do you want to go about this? Do you want to get the obvious shit out of the way first, or?
No, I have a strategy, but I'm not going to tell it to you. Like that's part of the fun of a draft is like, oh, fuck. Like, do you want to save it or do you want to burn it?
Okay. And then at the end of the thing, if we have any stragglers or things left over, we'll just rattle them off. But
the real question is who gets to go first?
Because normally we'd have a coin toss or something. I don't know. I don't watch sports.
Yeah, I don't know either. Sports fans write into the podcast and tell us how a draft normally starts. I don't know how to do this.
It's okay. We'll just... I'll be gracious. I'll let you go first.
Okay, and then
just so that we have a show,
and then I think it should just rotate.
Yeah,
so back like and next forth. Time you'll go first, then I'll go first, and then you'll go first.
All right.
Okay. So right out of the gate, when I think of 70s horror, there is one movie that immediately pops to my mind.
Yeah,
I think it is. I think it is sort of the archetypal horror movie.
Okay.
And I'm talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, that's definitely on my list.
Of course. Honestly, I'm sure both of our lists are basically the same. But
possibly.
That is like the horror movie of the 70s. And there's some good fucking horror movies in the 70s.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of horror movies in the 70s, and it's as a decade in general, not just in horror, but in film history, especially American film, there is so much happening. It's like one of those decades where every movie that comes out is like changing film.
Yeah, and somehow this movie, it's still, because you're right, but somehow this movie still sort of, not only defines 70s horror, but in a lot of ways defines horror to me. I think it, like some of those other franchise movies, like Halloween or Night on Elm Street or Friday the 13th, I think...
Well, there's been a few Texas Chainsaw movies.
Sure.
And I've seen more of them than I'd like to admit.
No, but what I was going to say is, generally speaking... the first ones of those franchises, I think some of them haven't aged super well. But I maintain that Texas Chainsaw is just as an effective horror movie today as it was in the 70s.
Whereas I maintain, and this might be controversial to some people, I think it's a masterpiece, like of any genre.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. Like, I think... this might be controversial. I think the first Halloween movie is pretty slow and dull. And I think this holds up with a more sort of modern sensibility.
Yeah, well, I think we start to see the beginnings of what we would later call extreme horror. So Texas Chainsaw sort of being a major and, you know, exploitation film in general, but Texas Chainsaw sort of like... aesthetically, and you know, Tobe Hooper is a director, his craft is a lot better than most exploitationers at the time, so it kind of has a sort of artfulness that a lot of those films don't, and it ended up influencing a lot of these European and Japanese filmmakers, and of course they don't have anything like the laws we have here. So you know, that ends up, so they take it to the nth degree, and that's how we end up with extreme horror in the 80s, 90s, and now. I did obvious pick, a good pick. And you know, this is also sort of a twice a year kind of thing for me. I can watch this movie in the middle of summer when it's hot and I'm sweating and you just feel miserable and the flies are everywhere.
Yeah.
Or you can watch it in and around Halloween too, because it's, you know, a good horror movie and brutally violent. All right. Heavy hitter right off the bat.
Yes.
Let's see. What do I want to go with here? Yeah, I'm going to go with, and this is actually the one I thought you were going to say, because I thought you were going to try and kneecap me on, one of my favorite movies of all time. This is like a top 10 for me. And it is Brian De Palma's Carrie.
Oh, I wasn't going to go for that. I thought you were going to say something else just now.
You know, this is, you know, the first Stephen King book, the first Stephen King movie adaptation. It sort of sets into stone a lot of his archetypes that you later see in everything else. But it's a little bit more compacted. It's a little bit more concise. It's a smaller story. It's a much more personal story. And in a lot of ways, even though this movie is, I think it dates in a good way. Like it becomes even more dreamlike and even more kind of otherworldly and surreal by the fact that you have this, like, that it's in this very, like, obvious 70s milieu. But Brian De Palma was such a pop filmmaker throughout his career that the way that he does contemporary filmmaking at the time, and you could say this of most of his movies up until the point in which he kind of lost it, but now it feels like this time capsule in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
Because he sort of captures a more sort of gauzy nostalgia of the decade, even though he was living it.
I think that's actually one of the things that I know how much you love Carrie, mm-hmm. and I appreciate Carrie.
Yeah.
But it is so 70s.
Yeah. That
it's a little harder for me. Again, I appreciate that it's a good movie, but mm-hmm. it's one of those movies that I, like, definitely have to be in a mood for.
Oh, man. I'm almost always in the mood for this movie.
I mean, it's on my list, but yeah. it's not one of my personal favorites, if that makes sense.
Fair enough. This movie also is powerhouse performances by both Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie. And it, you know, as a kid watching those scenes of them fighting back and forth and Piper Laurie dragging Sissy Spacek into the terrifying prayer closet and all of that stuff, it has this kind of intensity and sort of reality to it. You know, abuse in general is just really hard to watch, and that's mm-hmm. a really intense portrayal of emotional and sort of physical abuse.
Yeah.
But if you watch it later as an adult, and you know, watch it knowing Brian De Palma's kind of sensibility and his satirical edge, there's kind of a camp quality to the movie as well. That has endured. Like, this is the type of film that you could do as a drag performance.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, you know, the Adam Sandler had a whole stand-up bit about it. They're all going to laugh at you.
Exactly. Oh, it's a very kind of soundbitey movie. There's a lot of great one-liners. But there's some of the visuals, the sequence of Carrie after the prom burns down and she's just walking out in slow motion. Like, that is an incredible visual. You know, her washing the pig's blood off of her in the bathtub, which again circles back to the first scene of the film in slow motion when she has her first period in the shower and all of that stuff. It's just a really emotionally tender movie. Like, it is maybe that's why I appreciate it so much, is because it's so interior, like the character itself.
Yeah, I can see that.
But yeah, big fan. I watch it at least once a year.
All right. Okay. What am I gonna pick next? What am I going for, Cassidy? Again, I think I have a couple choices that I know for a fact are on your list. So I feel like I should go for one of those, and I'm going to go with, so I'm just going to get out of the way, Jaws.
Okay, yeah, you know, I actually, not even sure if I put that on my list.
Oh, what? That's like one of your favorite movies of all time.
No, I agreed. Go ahead. Talk to me about why Jaws is great.
I mean, do we have to? I feel like this...
You did this recently.
Also, I feel like this podcast could basically at some point spin off to like a Jaws fan cast. Like, we talk, this movie comes up a lot. I don't
think it does.
Our,
list,
we don't need to relitigate it too much. But it's a classic. I think on our last podcast, I said it was a perfect movie. Mm-hmm. Which I had a couple other answers for, by the way. But I won't get into that now. I just think it's flawless.
Let's have a conversation then about, you know, and this is this might be the thing that's contentious to some people. Is it a horror film?
Yes, it is. 100%. I think the film, just because it's a big blockbuster movie, does not make it not a horror film. It's designed to titillate. It's designed to thrill. Mm-hmm. It has sequences that are meant to horrify.
Yes.
I think it is a horror film. I just think some people don't want to classify it as a horror film because it's so palatable. And
yeah,
because horror as a genre, you know, it runs the gamut. It runs from Jaws, which is the big summer blockbuster that everybody's seen, that you can watch with your parents, whatever, to, you know, House of a Thousand Corpses. Like,
right.
Just because it's not hardcore horror hound material, I don't think disqualifies it from being a horror film.
There's some bloodletting. And I mean, there's a, you know, there's a decapitated head that pops up in somewhere in the movie.
Yeah, and are you talking about the part with, like, where Richard
Dreyfuss is diving? In the boat. Yeah, with Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's played for scares. That's
yeah,
a jump scare. Might be the first jump scare.
Probably not, but it's an iconic one for sure.
Yeah, the tension with the beginning, which plays out like a fucking serial killer moment. Like,
yeah, it does have a lot of the tropes. I mean, it has like the first kill, and then the, you know, the final person at the end, and versus the you know, the villain or what have you.
Just because this sort of spiraled off into, you know, total popcorn fodder later on,
right,
doesn't mean that this movie isn't.
Well, I think if you look at the movie, you know, the way it's shot, the way the characters play off of each other, the type of humor it has, sort of the vibe generally, I think the biggest, the heaviest hand on the film, influence-wise, is Hitchcock.
For sure, yeah.
And, you know, something like the Birds, if you just want to go with the animal attack angle. But even just, like, the way the characters interact with each other and sort of joke around with each other reminds me a lot of, like, a Hitchcock thriller where there would be those moments, even something like Psycho, which is his most, like, overtly horror, has those like moments of levity, and there's a lot of work in the characters, not just into the aesthetics and the horror aspects.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm glad Jaws is on there because it wouldn't have come up for me. Maybe I left it off because I thought you might. Okay. So then I'm going to get this one out of the way. I'm just going to, I'll go with this one.
Just do it.
The Exorcist.
You motherfucker. You motherfucker. I mean,
you really think I wouldn't say The Exorcist?
No, I of course not. It's that's such a solid entry.
When you said the definitive 70s horror film, I think of The Exorcist.
So, I mean, that's the definitive sort of.
I mean, all of the films we've talked about so far are pretty definitive.
Yeah, pretty iconic. I mean, This is the other side of the horror spectrum. Texas Chainsaw is brutal kill, eventually evolved.
Proto-slasher in a lot of ways. Yeah.
You know, it spawned the whole torture porn thing.
Arguably.
The Exorcist spawned the haunted house demon possession thing.
Yeah, well, of course, there have been a lot of paranormal horror films before The Exorcist, but never something as diabolical.
Like Texas Chainsaw, I think this sort of changed the game.
Yeah, certainly. I think one of the things to talk about when we're talking about 70s horror versus especially a lot of the later decades, or even the previous decades, like 60s and 50s, where horror generally done by like schlockmeisters, And I say that lovingly because I like a lot of those movies too. But what happened in the 70s is the new Hollywood movement, right? And the movie brats and all of these film school kids growing up watching like Bergman and Fellini and all of these things in the 60s when they were in college, going off making their first films and making this, you know, experimental art film for the masses and doing them with traditional genres. And that's how you end up with, you know, somebody like William Friedkin going from The French Connection to The Exorcist. And he's taking on horror, but he's dressing it up with as much prestige as he can. So you have somebody like Max von Sydow, who worked with Bergman, in the film, playing the priest, or playing the elder priest, not the main protagonist, but
yeah, not the titular exorcist.
Yeah,
the other exorcist.
Yeah, the other one, the less fortunate one. But it's you know, it's one of those movies that's to this day. This movie is old. This movie came out in what, 73, 72? And to this day, people are still comparing horror movies to this. So whenever like something they want as a marketing hook, they always say the scariest film since The Exorcist.
That's
like,
true.
That's bizarre, right? Like any movie that old is being used, is still a marketing hook.
For sure, yeah.
In 2018.
I mean,
like people don't say the scariest movie since Scream. They could. I like that movie a lot. But
well, we'll wait till we get to the
when we get to that. Or people don't say, you know, the scariest movie since The Ring. They still say the scariest movie since The Exorcist, because there's not only is there and a lot of times I think when critics are saying that, what they mean is this is scary, but it's also a good movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's like this is scary, but it's quality. It's not just jump scares, and it's not it's not Hellfest.
And this movie runs so cold. Like you watch it and you just feel like you're shivering, like you're in this constant state of unease. You know, yeah, it is the opposite of a jump scare kind of film.
Yeah, I this movie was one of those ones that I did not see till later in life, because
like
just the mention of it, just like seeing the poster of it was so fucking scary to me as a kid. Like just the idea of it, I just couldn't handle. And there was, you know, all the urban legends surrounding the movie. And it's this movie that, I mean, it sets the gold standard. It's sort of more mythic than anything. And then when I saw it, I was like, there's no way it can live up to that.
Right.
And I saw it and I was like, it doesn't live up to my expectations the way I thought it would.
It didn't traumatize you for life.
Yeah, but because when I saw it, I was like, oh, no, it's just a really fucking good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was way into it. I was like, oh, this I saw it when I was old enough to not be terrified by just the thought of it.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, I'm glad I saw this later, because I can appreciate it instead of like just being tortured by it.
Yes, and you know it's an interesting film. It's a movie that's kind of is concerned with ideas beyond just like trying to scare you to death. It's a movie about what it's like to be a single mother. It's about, you know, the fact that it takes place in Washington D.C. is really interesting, and it's concerns of sort of the fear of female sexuality, and how that was kind of changing during the time of like women's liberation and that kind of stuff. So, and of course the major overarching theme, which is a little bit more of a little bit more than subtext, the ideas of faith and how you wrestle with that, as you get older and become kind of world weary. So it's a movie, you know, a lot of people have called their favorite movie because you can kind of revisit it and get something out of it every time.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And obviously still wildly influential.
Yeah. So we've said four now, so we have six to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I'm going to get the last, I think, in my mind, totally obvious one out of the way.
Okay.
And that's Alien.
Oh, okay.
What the fuck? What is on your fucking list? How does Alien not make it on the list?
No, Alien's on my list. That's just not what I thought you were going to say, but go ahead.
When I was making this list, I was like, almost didn't want to say Jaws and Alien because we talk about them so fucking much already.
Right. Well, that's why I said, let's get the obvious stuff out of the way first, then we can get more interesting here in a bit.
Yeah. Again, if you really want a deep dive, go revisit our, didn't we review like all of them at
one all point? The Alien movies. Yeah. If you look at our Alien Covenant review, we review all the Alien movies up to it, including the Alien versus Predator movies, tying it into this week's review.
Yeah, so I think we don't have to get into this one too much.
No.
Like Jaws, I think it's pretty much a perfect movie.
Yeah.
It's from the set design to the acting, everything is gorgeous. And it's sci-fi. So it combines, you know, horror with sci-fi, which I love sci-fi. If you can sprinkle a little bit of sci-fi into your horror movie, I'm probably going to like it just that much more.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a whole lot to add to that. You know, it kind of redefined what outer space looked like in film up to that point. And Star Wars had come out not too long before it. Mm-hmm. That was a totally different take. That was much more kind of a fantasy thing. And then, you know, less than a decade before that, 2001 kind of had this sort of optimistic-ish view of outer space exploration and sort of based on like NASA and the space race and that kind of stuff. And this was like the industrial outer space. And it looks, you know, like an oil rig or something like that. And yeah, you mentioned the production design, the creature design, totally bizarre. And I think we take that for granted now. We've seen the Xenomorph as action figures.
Oh, I don't fucking take it for granted. I still, again, talking about gold standards.
Yeah.
I ever since like the overly like hyper detailed monster design of like Cloverfield.
Okay. Yeah.
Has come out. I think that movie monsters have been so fucking bland and I think generic looking. And I can't think of just about any monster since Alien that has topped the design of the Xenomorph.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, the trailers, the original trailers, the Nobody Can Hear You Scream in Space trailers, they don't give too much of it away, and of course the movie hides the Xenomorph for a lot of it as well, because it's such a great design. You can't, like, what I was going to say originally, like, imagine not knowing what Alien is, sitting in the theater seeing Alien for the first time. It had to have been just the most terrifying thing in the world.
Yeah, it still is. Yeah. And that's you know, like, I just barely got a loot crate with a cute little, like, vinyl Alien action figure, like, walking a face hugger like it's a dog and it's, like, peeing acid on a fire hydrant. And it's adorable. But, you know, even seeing shit like that, like, literally every day.
Yeah.
If you just take a moment and think about the design of the creature, I don't think it's been topped.
Yeah. Great. Cool. Well, let's see. What do I want to go with next? I think this time I'm going to dip into something a little less obvious. We're going to go to the end of the 70s, and that is 1979's The Brood by David Cronenberg. This is
this one I haven't seen.
Third or fourth film, I want to say. And in a lot of ways, I think this is like the beginning of his hot streak. You know, he made some interesting stuff in the 70s, the Rabid Shivers. Some exploitation movies or whatever. But, The Brood, I think, was really where he kind of, starts to become the David Cronenberg that we know. And it's again, a very intellectual film on top of being an effective horror film. It's a very creepy concept, this idea that, I mean, I don't want to give stuff away, especially since you haven't seen it. Because it is one of those ones I think it's more interesting the less you know. But, you know, David Cronenberg just come out of a divorce, and he said this was his version of Kramer versus Kramer. Okay. And it is, you know, kind of a dark, hateful movie. Not, dare I say, kind of misogynistic. I would say actually pretty misogynistic. But the way that he kind of externalizes this sort of conflict between a divorce or whatever is totally only something that he could create. It's a really gross movie in some regards too.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, The Brood. If you've never seen it,
I haven't. I'll have to make the effort.
Mm-hmm. Criterion released it a little while ago, and it looks pretty good.
Okay. All right. This one was one of the first horror movies that I saw with my parents. Actually, we watched it at one Halloween. I was still pretty young, and it left an impression. But I'm talking about the 70s version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, okay.
Donald Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of it was so creepy, and I think we saw like a 90s version of it first.
The Abel Ferrara one, yeah.
Yeah, and my parents didn't like it, and they were like really disappointed by it as a remake. So they were like, "No, you have to watch the 70s version." And so they made me watch it, and yeah, I ended up liking it a lot more.
Mm-hmm. The 70s version being a remake as well.
Yes, yeah.
The original, I think, having early 60s, late 50s.
Yeah, but to me, that's the definitive version. I don't know. It just seems like, because it's been remade a couple times. I didn't even see the one with Nicole Kidman.
All right, The Invasion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But just like, it was just one of those movies that the concept freaked me out of. And then I do think this movie is a little dull at parts. I think it might be a little overly long. But I just remember the ending. It's one of the first movies that I saw that had just a totally, like, nihilistic, we're fucked kind of ending.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give too much away if people haven't seen it. But I just remember it was one of those movies that sort of stuck to my guts.
All right. Yeah. You know, I've actually never seen this one.
Yeah. So I mean, it's very 70s.
Yeah.
That's the one thing I'll say about it. Kind of like some of my hangups with Carrie, it's a little dated, but it's still got some cool stuff in there, and a great performance by young Donald Sutherland, and I think a young Jeff Goldblum is in it. Once it gets going, it's pretty good.
All right.
But it has been a long time since I've seen it, so I hope that it's not too much nostalgia blinders.
I think it's generally well regarded. Actually, most of the Invasion movies are pretty well regarded, maybe with the exception of the last one. But okay, where do I want to go now? Let's do another personal favorite of mine, and this one's a little hard to track down, actually, because it's never really had a proper American release. But I'm going with Ken Russell's The Devils, and this was his take on
It's just called The Devils?
The Devils.
You said that like there was another word coming.
No, not The Devil Wears Prada. The Devils, this is based on the book by Aldous Huxley, and it's kind of a genre hybrid. It's certainly has some horrific stuff in it, but it's about a priest during, like, the, I guess, Enlightenment era, who is sleeping with all of the nuns who are kind of writhing in some sort of satanic sexual lust. And he leaves, the priest being played by Oliver Reed, leaves. Oh, this is the second time Oliver Reed comes up in my list because he was also in The Brood. But he leaves, and when he comes back, he is actually being tried by a corrupt government who is trying to close down his influence on this village, and things just get really fucked up from there. And this is it's a historical piece. It's also, there's elements of kind of possession film or what have you here, even 1971, so it's even before The Exorcist as far as that goes. And it's an English film. Ken Russell will be later going on to make movies like Tommy, the movie based on the Who album. But
not Tommy Boy.
Not Tommy Boy. Starring Chris Farley. No. the production design is absolutely like out of this world. Even though it's like you know a historical piece, there's like, it's kind of a costume drama. Kind of feels a little Caligula-ish at times. It's just a one of those kind of like cult films that has sort of been legendary. There's a scene in the film in which Oliver Reed is depicted as Christ ascending to Golgotha with the cross on his shoulder, and a nun decides to take advantage of him on his way there. This scene has caused the film to be endlessly cut and recut and cut again, and I don't know if an original version of the film is even actually available to see.
Really?
Because of that. And other scenes in the film as well that were too risque at the time. Of course, England had the video nasties for a really long time. Even past the time, we had the R rating and that kind of stuff and the X rating in America. There were just certain movies that the British, FCC or whatever they call it over there would deem unfit to be distributed. So they would say these are, these is in the pile of the video nasties, they were banished. Of course, that only made the movies more popular amongst tape traders and horror geeks in the 80s. And this movie, I think has had a couple like, English only DVD releases. I watched it on YouTube a long time ago. And, I think now you can probably, download it or whatever pretty easily. But, The Devils, it's a weird one. And I saw it projected here at the Arrow a little while back too, with a documentary about Derek Jarman, the director who was the production designer on this film. And he would go on, to be a really influential LGBT filmmaker in the 80s and 90s.
All right, cool. All right, so this is my last pick, right? Yeah, okay. All right, I figured there's one more that I gotta mention to bring us home strong, and that is George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead.
Okay, yeah, this is what I thought you were gonna say last time.
I think it's still one of the best zombie movies. I maintain this is Romero's best. Well, I don't know. Night of the Living Dead is pretty fucking good, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, it has, like, all of the fun of zombies. It's got, the survivalist aspect.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the... I would say maybe my one complaint is the zombie makeup is a little goofy. Because they got like those weird blue faces,
right?
It's a fun movie. I think this movie is sort of showing us how fun zombies can be. Whereas Night of the Living Dead, I think, is a bit more of a political statement.
It's a bleaker film, yeah. A lot of people talk about Night of the Living or Dawn of the Dead being a political statement about capitalism and about consumerism as well, and mall culture and all that stuff.
And I think that's in there, but I just think that the political subtext is a little bit more hidden under, just this fun zombie survivalist horror aspect of it.
Yeah. This is certainly the most influential of Romero's zombie films, the first three, the only three that count in my mind. And it's the one that that has been endlessly copied. You know, basically all the zombie rules come out of this film. And Night of the Living Dead as well established some of them. But, you know, especially like things like The Walking Dead wouldn't exist if Night of the Living or Dawn of the Dead hadn't been made.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this whole idea of like, you know, we're going to barricade this area and we're going to, you know, live off of these supplies and then like infighting in the groups and all that stuff. This is where this all comes from.
Yeah. And then there's even you know, the whole the biker gang that shows up and like that whole idea that humans are still more dangerous than the monsters. Yeah. Like, you know, who are the real monsters? Like, that's all in here.
Yeah. Which is Romero's personal politics that, you know, span the majority of his career.
Yeah, for sure. So, Dawn of the Dead, getting it out there.
Yeah, all right. All right. So, this is my last pick, right?
Yep. This is it. This is it for the 70s.
All right. And I'll just count us down just so we know what we've been talking about so far. Keith comes in first with Jaws. I said Carrie.
You came in first with
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I came in with Carrie. Then you said Jaws. I said The Exorcist. You said Alien. I said The Brood. You say Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The Devils. And then last, Dawn of the Dead. And I'm going to close this out with a film that I don't think is actually, technically speaking, a great film. But legacy-wise, it's insanely important. And that is Wes Craven's first film, Last House on the Left.
Okay. I flirted with the idea of putting this on my list, but I just couldn't do it because I actually just don't really like this movie.
No, and it's not a film that wants you to like it.
It's ugly and uncomfortable and hard to watch.
Yes, it is all of those things. So Wes Craven was a raised fundamentalist Christian. And then he goes to college in the 60s, as a lot of these film brats did, and falls in love with film through college cinema. So he sees all of the greats and all of the, you know, all of the European stuff that's influxing in America. And he decides he wants to be a filmmaker. Of course, the only way he can do that is to do something genre first, to get his name out there and do something that can be made cheaply. So he decides to do an American remake of Ingmar Bergman's The Virgin Spring as Last House on the Left. And he takes it out of the Middle Ages and puts it into contemporary 1970s. And he's a pretty young filmmaker. He doesn't exactly know what he's doing. But him and his hippie friends go off in the woods and make this insanely powerful and disturbing film. And some of the reasons it's so powerful and as disturbing as it is because he doesn't know what he's doing. So he mixes tones in weird ways. There's like these comedic bits in between these jarring sequences of rape and mutilation. This is an exploitation film. Another film like Texas Chainsaw Massacre that kind of its reputation and its popularity outlived the exploitation underground or whatever you want, however you want to qualify that. But this is, you know, this was made to be like a grindhouse or a drive-in kind of movie. And there's certain aspects of it that feel, and I think that this is the reason why it feels so powerful. And there's another film kind of like it, that came out later, out of Italy called Cannibal Holocaust. And they both have this feeling like you don't feel like you're in safe hands with the filmmaker because you feel like he's going to cross a line because he doesn't know where the lines are.
Yeah. I'm going to say this movie does that.
No. Yes. And Cannibal Holocaust even more so. And that's the reason why it's as distinct as it is, but I think, you know, he later went on to go in the 70s to make The Hills Have Eyes, which is a little bit more of a cleaned up, like efficient version of the same idea. But I actually think this movie is the more interesting of the two. even though technically speaking, it's probably not as well made. I think this one feels more original and it feels more vital as a piece of filmmaking. And, you know, some people have said this is like smack dab in the middle of like the Vietnam thing. So we're seeing young people dying all the time, coming back in body bags and seeing this footage of, you know, soldiers being mutilated and whatever. Then maybe that had some sort of influence on Wes Craven when he made the movie. Who's to say? Yeah, I think this is an important piece of 70s filmmaking, launched, you know, one of the horror greats, actually two, because, the director who would later go on to make, Friday the 13th was, sort of a co-director of this film.
That's a fun fact.
So yeah, Last House on the Left. I can't say you're going to like it if you've never seen it before. It dates real hard, and the sequences of brutality are really, really, really difficult to see, even today.
I'm actually not even sure if I finished this one.
I think you watched it with us. Yeah, I remember watching it as a group in college.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know, like I wanted to sort of talk through it or like... I might have like left and gone and like done something else because I remember really not enjoying it. I agree with all the things you're saying, and I can see how it can be vital to film history.
Yeah.
I flirted with putting it on my list because I know that it was pretty influential, but just at the end of the day, I was like, I just didn't enjoy this movie because it's so fucking hard to watch. I think it's fair to put it on the list.
Yeah. All right. Top 10 draft of the 1970s horror. Did you want to rattle off? Yeah. What didn't come up in this list that you still have down?
Yeah. And we don't need to talk about them in detail. But the only ones that didn't. That we didn't talk about was I put the original Amityville Horror.
Okay.
Because I think it's also pretty good at doing the haunted house slasher thing.
And deeply influential, especially now.
Yeah.
Like Blumhouse pretty much exists because of those tropes.
For sure. So I feel like it deserves an honorable mention. And this one, I actually don't even think this counts as a horror film, but it has the word horror in the name, so the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I count it as a Halloween film. Maybe not a horror film, but definitely a Halloween film.
Exactly. So I feel like I didn't really want to put it on my draft list, but I do feel like it deserves some kind of a shout out.
For sure.
Then that's it for me.
That's everything it for you? Everything else came up?
Yeah.
All right. And neither of us said John Carpenter's Halloween. And I honestly just didn't say it because I thought you would. So, and there were things I wanted to talk about more because they were just less obvious. Yes, obviously, Halloween. See it. Suspiria.
I just found it kind of dull, the first Halloween. I don't know.
I think it's spare. It's minimalist. And I think that... that's sort of what I like about it is its efficiency. I'll be interested to see the new one that's coming out here in a little bit.
Yeah, I'm fucking excited for it. But anyway.
Suspiria, I have on my list as well.
See, that one I thought for sure you were going to bring up.
Well, that's another one that's going to be remade here pretty soon by Luca Guadagnino, who just recently did Call Me By Your Name. And I've heard... really interesting things early on about the remake, but Suspiria, dreamlike, weird, surreal, Italian giallo, all that stuff. Interesting.
I'm pretty sure you made me watch this one too.
It's a possibility. The original Wicker Man, which like the Devils is kind of like a genre hybrid. It's a thriller. It's a whodunit kind of thing, but then it's sort of like, flips up and changes into something else within the second act. It's kind of low-key a musical, which nobody talks about. and it's a totally an original piece of British filmmaking. Yeah, that's the two things that and The Devil have in common. They're both British films. And I also have The Hills Have Eyes, which I kind of talked about a little bit in conjunction with Last House on the Left, because they are kind of sister films in a way. But yeah, there you go.
All right.
Well, I hope people enjoyed that, because it ate up a lot of podcast time. So now we're going to talk
about...
Great,
way to remind the listeners how long they've been listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoyed all the garbage up till now. Way to bury the lead.
Let's go ahead and get into Shane Black's The Predator, and I'm going to let you set that up.
Okay, so there is this super sniper who's in the middle of an assassination mission. With his crew, and a predator crash lands into that. He has a brief encounter with the predator, is able to steal some alien tech, which he ships to his divorced wife. I'm assuming estranged wife and son, for safekeeping. The boy opens the package and accidentally summons the predator's location. So the super sniper, after encountering this alien, ends up with a ragtag group of ex-soldiers that have to come together to save his son from the monster.
Yeah.
Is that enough? Do we need more?
I think that's more than enough. So it's kind of interesting. I saw this, and then a little bit later, I rewatched the original Predator. And it's been a minute since I've seen the original Predator. So I forgot that one of the original soldiers in the original Predator was played by Shane Black. Which is incredible, because if you didn't know that, you would think that Shane Black had never seen the original Predator.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's amazing. Yeah, are we just getting into it?
Oh, yeah.
So this movie's trash.
This movie's garbage.
It is white hot trash. And I was so excited for this movie.
I know.
And I feel like...
You feel hoodwinked, right?
I feel...
Like,
yeah.
Almost trolled?
Yeah. Like, I think this might be worse than the Alien versus Predator movies. And it's like right on par with Alien vs. Predator Requiem. This movie is white hot garbage.
I didn't think it was quite that bad, but I will say it reminded me of it way more than it should have.
I don't know if there was like there was barely anything redeemable in this movie for me. And I think the only thing that I actually enjoyed was Sterling K. Brown.
Okay. Who did he play in the movie? Because I'm forgetting.
He was like the villain scientist.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was kind of eating it up in the way he seemed like, and I say this often, maybe too much, but he seemed like the only one who knew what movie he was in.
Yeah. He was like this fun, campy villain, chewing scenery. Mm-hmm. And he's just such a damn fucking good actor that he can make anything work. I am convinced of it.
Apparently. Yeah. At least the brief sequences where he's in the film.
Yeah. So this movie is all over the place.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. It feels like to me what happened was Shane Black wanted to make an A-Team movie. Mm-hmm. And then a movie studio was like, we can't sell an A-Team movie because we already made a remake that didn't do well. What if you jam-pack a bunch of Predator nonsense into it?
Yeah.
And here's a half-written script that we've already done that you have to make work with your script.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It definitely feels like a too many cooks in the kitchen kind of situation, and like a recut city happened here. Because there's so many sequences like that it decides to edit from and, you know, go from one thing to another, and cross-cutting, you know, through these different scenarios that are just so jarring. And
I feel like, and I know Shane Black knows better than this.
Yeah, I don't understand. You know, some people, I think, kind of felt this way a little bit about his Iron Man entry. Iron Man 3. And there's elements of Iron Man 3 that are kind of sending up the first two Iron Man movies in a way that's similar to what I think this movie's doing or trying to do, is to sort of send
Iron
up.
Iron Man can tell, like, a cohesive story.
Yeah, that movie, I think, still, like, maybe, you know, Kevin Feige or something kind of reeled it in enough so that it felt like a piece of the general Marvel canon. But
between this and Iron Man was The Nice Guys, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, well, and then that was kind of more of a passion project, of, you know, a personal kind of thing where he really just got to make the thing he wants to do. It feels like to me like he made this begrudgingly. Like he's mad at this movie. Like, he's not mad in an interesting way. Like, he's like letting it out in any kind of way. It feels like he's trolling us.
Yeah,
like he's trying to make it suck.
Yeah, it's so bad.
And there's magical autistic children in this movie.
Oh my god. Oh my god. Here's the thing.
Jacob Tremblay, who's a great little actor, you know, he was up for an Oscar, I think, with that movie Room, and god did he pick the wrong next project.
Right. And you know what though? the magical autism, doesn't even, like, top my list of things that are wrong with this movie. That's how bad this movie is. No,
the dialogue is terrible. Like, it's kind of Shane Blacky in that, like, quick, witty, whatever. But it's obnoxiously vulgar for no reason.
Yeah, there's also a character with Tourette's, so, you know.
Have fun with that. Yeah, Thomas Jane.
We're running the gamut on problematic disabilities to give our characters and treat them in amazingly unsensitive manners.
Yeah, I wrote in my review, this is a movie that has Olivia Munn, Keegan-Michael Key, Thomas Jane, and doesn't know what to do with any of them.
This movie should have worked. So when I saw this, I actually saw it in a completely empty theater.
Mm-hmm.
I was all by myself.
So was I. But, I mean, that's not uncommon for me.
Oh, really? To me, that was a very weird experience. I was a little uncomfortable by that. And so part of me was like, do I just need people around me so I can, like, gauge a movie off of them? Because I was like, I felt like I was... Yeah, like being trolled. I was like, am I just missing something?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was so...
How
just
early rushed. Did you get the vibes? Because for me, it was scene one.
Yeah,
it was like one or two where I was like... And I got that it was a reference to... There's a lot of referencing going on in the movie. But yeah, like really early on, I was like, why does this suck a little? And then, like, as the movie kept going, I'm like, no, this is bad. This is, like, just a bad movie. And it thinks it's like, oh, but that's the point? But I'm like, no. It's coming all the way back around to being unironically bad again.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't Gremlins 2, even though I think that's what Shane Black thinks he's doing.
Do you?
I think. Give him any benefit of a doubt at all, if he didn't just, like... take a wet fart on a snare drum and call it Predator. I think he thinks he's making like Gremlins 2 or his version of Bride of Frankenstein or something. Just something kind of like so over the top and campy and just like taking the tropes and turning them all around.
I spoke to a coworker who saw it and that's what he got from it. And he like,
yeah,
he thought it was really fun. And I was like, no, like it wasn't fun. It wasn't it to me. This wasn't so bad. It's good. This was unintentionally, cynically, poorly made. This is like just a not well done movie. Like it can't even have fun with the camp. And there were a couple moments where I was like, yeah, that feels like what this was trying for it a couple of times. Like when there were a couple little moments where the Predator, I found him a little charming. and a little to have a bit more personality than some of the fucking human actors.
Yeah, Jesus.
And then, okay, maybe we're building to something kind of interesting with, like, the way he's fucking with people. Because there were moments where he wasn't just, like, brutally murdering people to be a predator.
Yeah.
You know, like, the part where he grabs the thumbs up thing. I was like, oh, yeah, all right.
Well, they kind of play with the idea that, you know, and it goes nowhere eventually, but they play with this idea that he's a predator on the run. He's on the lam, which is kind of interesting as a concept. Like, probably somewhere there was a better screenplay where that was the focus.
There's five movies in this movie.
Yeah. And so his intentions or his motivations as a creature, as a villain, is different than we've seen in other Predator movies. But again, it's so, like, drowned in, like, a thousand other things this movie's trying to do and not doing any of it well.
And that storyline literally gets smashed into pieces.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, like, all the main characters, I wanted to like them. These are all actors I like and I know are capable of doing interesting things. And I
Keegan
wonder,
Michael Key didn't make me laugh once. What the fuck?
I wonder if it was due to editing, because I felt like that scene, like, where they're on the bus was really chopped up.
What about that scene where they're back with the main character's wife and kid, and it feels like it goes on forever?
Oh, my God. And then let's not forget the fact that we're, like, an hour and 45 minutes deep into this motherfucking movie before it remembers it's a Predator movie and starts killing characters off. And then it's like, that scene was so fucking ridiculous and bad.
Yeah.
And it's just...
Well, that's what it's like. It's like, okay, so the original Predator is Predator in the jungle. Then the second one is Predator in the urban jungle in the middle of, like, the streets or what have you. And then this one's supposed to be Predator in the suburbs, right? That reminded me...
Let's not throw out Robert Rodriguez's Predators that's on the Predator planet.
Yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily in canon as far as what this movie's going from.
I think it is.
It might be because there's the Predator dog. But anyway.
Yeah, there's nothing exclusively like.
But this is supposed to be Predator in the suburbs, which that's what was giving me that and the general shittiness was giving me the flashbacks of Predator, Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
Yeah, which that Predator in the suburbs already isn't, like, terribly interesting to me, but it's not.
It doesn't have to be this bad, though.
Yeah. It's not a non-starter. It's like, okay, why? I guess, whatever, sure, why not? But yeah, it just does nothing interesting with that at all. It's just an excuse to have this little boy in the movie for some reason. And then
Shane Black has a weird kid thing. And I'm not saying that in, like, a creepy way, exactly, but, like, fucking every movie he does, he has to introduce this child who represents sort of the morality of the heart of the film. And
yeah.
And I know he likes his tropes and he likes to be known for certain things, but this is one where some producer somewhere had to say, get rid of the kid.
Also, the tone of this movie, like, what audience was this marketing to?
I don't know. Like, because there, one of the things I was going to say about it is it also feels really toyetic in a way.
Yeah.
Like it feels like this would be like of the 2-hour pilot to a sci-fi Predator television series from 1999.
Yeah. But it's got like these very, even the night scenes are very brightly lit.
Yeah,
We get to see way more of the Predator than we ever should, and it's mostly really bad CGI.
CGI is not great, no. And then, I feel like there's things in the movie that were created just to sell them later, like the Predator dog and like the helmet and the wrist arm thing. But
here's the thing: it's shot like the fucking Monster Trucks movie. Remember that movie that came out last year that was like the truck that was also like an alien?
Transformers?
No, it's called Monster Trucks.
I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Oh my god. Oh, if that ever comes on Netflix, you are in for the pain. I didn't see it, but man, it looked bad. But it feels like, or like that robot dog movie that came out earlier this year.
Axel. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like the Power Rangers movie. Like, it yeah. has the sort of feel, like the look of that type of sort of young adult, not even mm-hmm. young adult, like preteen sort of action pseudo blockbuster on uh-huh. a budget. It has that kind of look. But violence and the language. Here's the thing. I'm not bothered by fucking foul language. But when it's awful dialogue, I'm bothered by it.
Yeah. And when it feels like it's like written by an eighth grader.
Yeah. Like the scene.
Like someone who hasn't learned how to swear yet.
Right. The scene with Olivia Munn in the hotel room is cringeworthy.
Yeah.
And with her interaction with Thomas Jane.
Yeah.
And I was coming out of my skin while watching a lot of this movie. It was just like, I wanted to leave, but I didn't.
You held in there. Yeah. Yeah, I would say this is one of the worst, like, what the fuck sequels.
Yeah, this
is one of those how did this get made type of movies.
I think it's worse than that even. Like I think this is going from Mortal Kombat to Mortal Kombat Annihilation. This is like doesn't even deserve to be anything.
I do think it will be riff tractable later. Like I know you don't think it's like too bad it's or so bad it's good, and I kind of don't either. But just to watch on its own. But I think that Riff Tracks or I guess Mystery Science Theater 3000 is back now. I would imagine they'd tear this thing apart pretty well. Red Letter Media probably did a pretty killer review of it. So if you're into that, this movie saving grace is giving clever people something to bitch about.
Yeah, I'm just going to say this now. Just uh-huh. stop. Just stop with the Predators. Just stop with the aliens. We're done with them. We're done. I felt like if anyone could bring, Predator back in a big way, it should be Shane Black. Like, the marketing for this movie made itself.
Yeah.
But no, it's just I don't want to see anything else that's related to this. And the fucking ending that was like trying to set up for a sequel.
Yeah, I'm like, nope.
God.
That's not happening.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah, there's like aspects of this movie that feel like Jason X.
Yeah. Yeah. It's bad.
Yeah. So I gave it a D, but I think I hate it worse now. I think it might earn an F.
I gave it a D minus originally, like walking out of the theater.
Yeah.
But yeah, after talking it out, I think the only thing that might bump it up from an F to a D minus is Sterling K. Brown is pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
He literally was the only saving grace for me in this movie. So. Yeah, I'm just going to say it's an F.
Yeah.
It's a big old fat fucking F.
Yeah.
All right.
I felt like I was punched in the gut with that movie. Let's go ahead and finish us out here with 1976, A Star is Born, our Netflix homework, which isn't on Netflix anymore, actually. Oh,
really?
Yeah, I had to find a different way of watching it. So maybe they'll put it on there again, but the new one's coming out, so it's still relevant in conversation.
I'm actually surprised they would. I don't know, maybe it was a rights issue. That's weird.
I don't know. They put things on, they take things off, and then people write these articles like, "Look what's coming on Netflix next month!" Like it's a good thing, like it's a selling point. It's like, no, actually, it's sort of the worst thing about Netflix is it's inconsistent.
Yeah.
But Star is Born, 1976, starring Barbra Streisand, Kris Kristofferson, Gary Busey, which I didn't know. before watching it, but he's really Gary Busey in it.
Okay, hold on. To get back to Predators, to the Predator for just a second. So Jake Busey is the Predator, and he is playing Gary Busey's son from Predator 2. Which you would you fucking did you know that?
No, because it's been a long time since I've seen Predator 2.
So what's the and also he was barely in the movie and did shit all. Like what the fuck? Again, everything on this about this movie worked on paper. Like that we're getting Gary Busey's son. That's fucking great, and he's played by his actual son. Come on. And they just fucking wasted it. Sorry. Anyway, but yeah, Gary Busey is in A Star Is Born.
It's in A Star Is Born. So this is the second remake of this movie. There's one made in the 30s. There's one made in the famous one made in the 50s with Judy Garland, and then Frank Pearson made this kind of 70s rock musical reinterpretation of the film with the Barbara Streisand powerhouse singer, and it's. I guess tale as old as time. Chris Christopherson plays sort of a burnt out rock star who's like doing coke and can't remember the lines of his own songs and just isn't feeling it anymore. Totally burnt out by the industry. And he goes off to a club after one of his performances to disappear. He sees a small little nightclub act with Barbara Streisand and then two other black ladies, and they're calling themselves the Oreos. He gets in an altercation, somehow ends up leaving with Barbara Streisand, sort of tags along for a few days, and he shows her the high life of what it's like to be a rock star celebrity, and he decides that he wants to sort of pass on the torch, as it were, and give her the spotlight, and he sort of fosters a career for her while kind of sinking deeper into his problems, even though they end up getting married. And yeah, I mean, that's A Star Is Born. What did you think of this one?
I was a little all over the place with this one. So 1970s drama, musical romance starring Barbara Streisand. That's 2 hours plus long.
2 hours and 20,
Yeah, I was like, oh, here we fucking go. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Let's buckle up for this. To be totally fair, I'm not super familiar with Barbara Streisand as anything more than a cultural entity.
Right.
So I didn't know what to expect. All of that being said, I really enjoyed sort of the first act of this movie.
I agree.
The stuff with Christofferson burning out was pretty fun. He's a very charismatic, wild man.
Yeah. The BDE coming off.
BDE?
The Big Dick Energy coming off of Chris Christofferson this entire movie.
Yeah. I mean, he...
Even though... And he's a professional singer. You know, like, that's what he was before he was an actor. Like, this is right around the time that he sort of, like... This wasn't long after he was in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and all of those things. And he started getting into acting. But this idea that he's like supposed to be this like powerhouse like rock star. And I just don't think he's a very good singer.
Oh, I didn't have a problem with that. I actually, again,
maybe it works better for like, you know, folk country or whatever. Like that's what he does normally. But,
yeah, but like 70s Barbara Streisand, I was like, I actually was enjoying the music a lot more than I was expecting.
No, me too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the problem with this movie is it's 2 hours and 20 minutes fucking long.
Yeah, I was drawing X's with my fingers over scenes that didn't need to exist.
Yeah.
Especially towards the middle and end. I was like, why? Like, we definitely need less scenes of them riding horses in the desert.
You are such a passive aggressive cunt. But I agree. The problem is everything sort of post them getting married.
Yeah.
Is sort of dragged out a little too long. They play into the... the romance, the 70s romance of it a bit too much. And yeah. it being of the 70s, it's a bit overindulgent.
Well, here's the thing. I think there's two, there's kind of like a, you know, sort of like the decade itself. And particularly, you know, a filmmaker like this or whatever, trying to sort of reinterpret this material for a new decade and doing so pretty aggressively. I think that there is a little tug of war between the film's like classical Hollywood roots. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some like some nods to traditional movie musicals of the past and some nods to like the melodramas or the women's films of the like 50s and 40s and that kind of thing. And there's these scenes that are kind of like operatic and a little soap operatic. Particularly in the once they kind of get past the meet cute phase. And that's the stuff that I think feels tethered to an era that it shouldn't have. Like, I think if it was going to go like, oh, we're going to do this for real and we're going to like do the hard R gritty version of A Star Is Born where they're just fucking every other scene. That's fine. And that kind of stuff I sort of like. And I like the music and I like sort of the bombast of it.
Yeah.
And the scope of it, I actually do sort of appreciate. But some of the like cheesier melodramatic stuff.
Yeah, it was like once they got to the ranch, I was like,
yeah,
we're spending a lot of time at this ranch.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was like, I felt like the natural ebb and flow of the movie was, you know, like, oh, we've got like 15 minutes left.
Right.
Nope. We had like another fucking hour to go.
Yeah.
So that was my big criticism is I think if they could have cut this down to like a tight 90 minutes, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. Because I think it's a pretty, like, the story's engaging. I think the performances are good. I loved Barbara Streisand as well. I think she it was really fun to see her again, sort of in the early stages of their relationship when they would have these sort of verbal sparring matches. That,
yeah, you know, she can hold her own in a scene. She's a very good actress on top of being, you know, this.
Her voice is incredible. Are we going to go this whole review and not talk about her voice? Like,
yeah.
I feel like people need to check out this Barbara Streisand lady.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, this movie was tailored to her numbers and her belting and that kind of stuff. There's a lot of that in here.
I was like, holy fuck, am I a Barbara Streisand fan now?
Apparently. And I think that her and Kris Kristofferson have like good energy together and they have good chemistry. For me it's the same. It's just that second half it just kinda floats away and it gets sort of cheesy in a way that I don't care for
it drags on to the point of borderline irredeemable for me, because especially how much goodwill the movie earned through the beginning. I enjoyed the first part of it so much more than I was expecting.
Yeah.
That once it started to drag, I was like, why is this happening? Like, I was with you. You had me and now you're losing me. Like,
right.
It just, this movie outstays its welcome, but it's not bad.
No, it's not that. And, you know, I think this is probably like one of the lesser regarded versions of this movie in overall history. But I think it has its place. And it makes me slightly more interested to see the new one.
This feels like a movie that should be remade.
That it's archetypal enough that you can kind of put it in any decade, any scenario.
Yeah, so I get the cynical, like, oh, Hollywood's out of original ideas. But as far as remakes go, I'm like, this movie could use some updating. Lady Gaga playing Barbara Streisand is like a no-brainer.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh, of course. Of fucking course. I'm surprised there wasn't a 90s version with Madonna.
Yeah.
But, I'm actually a little excited for the new one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mildly recommend this one. I think you have to be open to the idea of musicals. Now, this isn't a traditional musical in the sense that it's just like in the middle of conversation, they start singing to each other non-diegetically. But it's a 70s musical. So it has a kind of like almost like Cabaret did that sort of Bob Fosse sort of thing. But not quite as not even as surreal as that. So
I would even say if you enjoy the movie Almost Famous, this is I feel like Almost Famous in a lot of ways drew from this because it's drawing from this era.
Yeah,
and it's not
the unglamorous underbelly of the rock experience.
Yeah. So
it has that like sleazy cocaine 70s thing, which is I'm all about.
For sure. That's what, like, kept me hanging in there.
Yeah. And now it's not as, like, batshit crazy as my favorite movies of this era, like Phantom of the Paradise. But, you know, not all movies can be Phantom of the Paradise. All right. And, what were you going to assign me for the next time you're on the podcast?
For our next Netflix homework is going to be The Void.
All right. Yeah, I know nothing about that, so we'll see what that is.
I don't really either, so this could be a mistake.
And you're not going to be on for the next episode. You're going to be taking a vacation, but we'll have you back on to discuss the 90s horror films.
I'm a little bummed out that I don't get to talk about the 80s.
Yeah.
Because that's such a high watermark, I think. So I might have to give you like my rundown when I come back.
For sure. Okay. Well, if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about in this episode, you can email us at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at jabberpodcast. And you can see my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. Be able to stream the show on, Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, Google Play, and Player.fm. And I think that's it. What's up?
Oh, yeah. So, book club this month, we're doing a really fun, I'm super excited for this. This is actually why I want to rewatch Interview with a Vampire. So book club, for those of you who don't know, is my improvised genre form. So we take a book genre and we improvise a full story every.
Yeah.
We have two shows a month. And this month for October, we're doing vampire romance.
All right.
I'm super excited. So you can check those out on October 13th. We should be back in town just in time to hit that show. And then October 27th at 9 p.m., you can get your tickets at www.oldtownimprov.com. You should come check it out because I'm super excited for this show.
So this is this is in San Diego, just so people know.
Yes.
So if you're local to SoCal, check out our other friends out there in the podcast world, including Rod and Macha over at the Listening Party, if they ever decide to do another episode. Dennis and Patrick over at Almost Educational, if they ever decide to do another episode. And Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast. Alice and Buddy over at Those Happy Places. And Mike Valick over at Hack Thought.
Yeah, also check out our friends Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast, which just got picked up by the Comedy Pop-Up Network, I think.
Ooh.
A little indie podcast network for comedy. Yeah, so congrats, Adam. Also, check out Campfire Shit Show with no I. So it's Campfire SHT Show with my friend Merrill. I think they just recorded a live episode, actually. So, they're both making some moves.
Doing some stuff.
Yeah, so good for them. That's it.
All right, cool. Then that's it. That's the episode.
Hey, I just wanted to take another look at you.
Bye.